And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and F1 heads to Suzuka for an unusually early Japanese Grand Prix, which will be a crucial challenge for teams still getting to grips with their 2024 cars. But who has the most to prove? And what's behind the shock technical departure at McLaren? I'm Ed Shaw, and joining us to reveal all are Glenn Freeman and Josh Suttill. Well, should we start with a correction? I think I need to do this because my inability to count properly meant that I said recently on this podcast that Andrea Kimi Antonelli still needs to secure some super license points to graduate to F1 next year, which is utterly incorrect. And I fell foul of something which I always particularly dislike people doing, which is confusing what the rules actually say with what I think they say. So the path is clear for Antonelli, regardless of what happens in F2.
Ed, are we going to require Valtteri Bottas to record a new jingle for Ed's Draw Apology Corner?
I'm hoping we don't have to do this as regularly as Valtteri Bottas Sympathy Corner turns up. I think we're 3-3 this season for Valtteri Bottas Sympathy Corner, and the way the Sauber pit stops are going, I'm not particularly optimistic about the chances of not needing to visit it again after Suzuka. But yeah, no, I thought that was important because it was just for some reason it was just lodged in my head. I thought they couldn't count both the Formula Regional titles just to get boring and into the rules, which I do actually like doing. You can count two championships in a year as long as they don't overlap, and I just in my mind made that you can only count one championship in a year, so he's fine. He just needs to turn 18 and he's eligible next year, so ignore anything I've said about Antonelli and super licenses in the future. But you've already jumped ahead of your introduction though, Glenn Freeman, but you have got something else exciting to talk about, which I'll pretend I don't know about even though I've participated.
Yeah, so this week, probably about a day after this podcast is released, the Race Members Club will see the debut of a new series, which is our Bring Back V10 spin-off, really, where we're doing a race-by-race revisit of the 1997 F1 season. So we're doing a mini-episode exclusively for our members on each race of the 97 season. Why 97? Because when we we did a World Cup for the best season, I think, amongst our community we have on X or Twitter, and 1997 came out of that as the winner. So it's the best season of the V10 era, according to a portion of our audience. And so, yeah, we're going to go back while we're between series in Bring Back V10s, and pretty much once a week with some other goodies for you for them in the Members Club in between. Ed is in that lineup, so it'll be Ed Straw, Matt Beer, Ben Anderson and myself. Just going back and just having a kind of a light-hearted, refresh our memories of each race of the 97 season. So we'd love to have as many people as possible to come and join us on that journey. So if that's something you think sounds interesting, now's a great time to sign up because you'd be getting in about a day before the series launches.
Perfect timing. And yeah, we've started recording that and it was good fun as well. We tried to make it feel a little bit different to the normal Bring Back V10s episode, but it still got some of that depth that you expect in it, which I just insisted on doing.
Some of that depth and some of that poking fun at Ed, which is what most of those episodes are for now.
I think what you mean is some opportunity to show my magnificent insight and things that must be said, but I'll leave it to the members to decide. They're a very discerning bunch of people. If you'd like to join that discerning bunch of people, as Glenn mentioned, check out the link in the description of this episode. Or also have a look on our website as well. Click on Join the Race and you'll find out more about that and all the other benefits of being a member. And Josh, finally we'll get to you. Welcome back to the F1 podcast. And while we are on the topic of Antonelli and my apology, how excited are you about him in general?
I'm incredibly excited. I'm incredibly excited to see him race in F1. And I really believe that that's going to happen next year. And I'm hopeful, as I have been from day one since Hamilton announced he was leaving to Ferrari. I hope it's going to be in a Mercedes. I think he's the correct pick. I think he's been the correct pick for a while, and I think he's only going to improve his case as the year goes on. I think he's going to learn far more, you know, in 1 year at Mercedes than he will in two or three at Williams. So I'm hopeful Mercedes are feeling bold and they're going to put him in the car. Of course, you know, driving for a top team straight away in F1, there's always going to be that question of, you know, can a driver handle it? But Antonelli, throughout his whole junior career so far, has just shown so much strength, so much mental capability, you know, well beyond his years. So I have faith that he'd be the perfect choice. And he's also got an extremely comprehensive test program as well planned with Mercedes this year. I mean, you know, it really pales in comparison, modern test programs, to what drivers used to have, to what Hamilton had in 2006. But what Antonelli has, is, as far as modern test programs go, is really, really comprehensive. And that's going to kick off in mid-April at the Red Bull Ring. He's going to be driving a race-winning Mercedes, a title-challenging Mercedes, at the 2021 car. And he's going to get a couple of days there to kick off the program, and then expect to see him both in that car and in the one of the ground effect hero cars as well. Plenty more times this year. He'll all be behind closed doors, but I'm sure Mercedes will be revealing a little glimpses of what's going on. And inevitably, he's going to be in some free practice ones, at least with perhaps, you know, Williams, Mercedes, and I wouldn't even be surprised to see him elsewhere on the grid as well, especially if Mercedes are serious about getting him in the car next year. Then really they should be walking down to Aston Martin, to anyone else on the grid, and saying, we'll give you a bit of money in exchange to run him in FP1. So yeah, keep an eye on that.
Yeah, and I think those private tests will probably play a bigger part in deciding whether he gets the drive, perhaps, in his F2 antics ultimately, but certainly very highly rated. Interesting to plot his progress. Let's get into the serious business of the podcast now, because Josh, there was some shock news in the build-up to the Japanese Grand Prix with the announcement that David Sanchez has left McLaren just 3 months after joining the team. So what's the story there?
Yeah, well, you remember back in February 2023, well over a year ago, that's when Sanchez agreed to join McLaren. Obviously, back then, he was working for Ferrari. He'd been immensely successful. He'd, you know, had a big contribution for many of the best Ferraris in this hybrid era so far, was very highly rated and was very much, you know, quite a good signing for McLaren at the time. He's obviously made quite a few big technical hires around that same time. But he had a really lengthy period of gardening leave that he had to undertake. So he didn't actually start work until the start of this year. And then just 3 months later, sort of out of nowhere, a bit of a shock, he's already departed the team. So just 3 months into working. Yeah, it's a big shock. I mean, from the release, obviously, it quotes both Sanchez and the team. So clearly it's been amicable, because there's involvement there from Sanchez. And I think it's quite pragmatic, actually, that they've both sort of said, well, you know, this isn't how we expected it was going to be, so let's stop it and let's allow both the team and Sanchez to pursue other alternatives. It basically means that Stella is going to be covering Sanchez's old role, which is exactly what he was doing last year during Sanchez's period of gardening leave. So he's going to take that technical director of performance kind of remit back under Stella's remit. You've got Rob Marshall, obviously the guy who joined from Red Bull as well, who started at the beginning of this year, and he's going to be the new chief designer. His new deputy, Neil Holdley, is going to be the technical director of engineering now. Like I say, Stella's going to be covering that performance route, and Peter Prodromo is still going to be technical director of aerodynamics. So it's still that kind of complex structure, but it's been slightly tweaked now with this announcement. It sounds obviously like whatever role he thought he was going to have hasn't really come to fruition within this slightly changed McLaren. Because remember, when he initially signed was when James Key was still the technical director at McLaren. So McLaren that he's now started working has obviously changed from then. Purely from the release, you'd guess obviously that has something to do with it. But it's going to be one of those things where we're going to have to wait to kind of hear from McLaren and wait to kind of for more stuff to emerge to kind of fully understand why this has happened. But that's what you can sort of judge from the initial release.
Yeah, it does appear quite clear that it's not quite the more senior or overarching role, because it is a very senior role, whatever happens, that he envisaged. And obviously, Glenn, it's not good that this has happened. This will, of course, disruption. Having to change your plans is never good. But I guess it's at least positive, as Josh alluded to, that they've taken action. They're not just sitting with it and hoping it sorts itself out. 3 months, they've realised it's not working, and parted company. So that's at least positive in terms of decisive handling of the situation, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the worst things you can do in a situation like this is be too proud to admit that it's not working, or to decide that you don't want to release this person back onto the open market. There'd be lots of reasons for McLaren or any other team in this situation to find a reason to keep someone when it's not working for whatever reason. So I'm quite impressed with the handling of it and the way they've delivered the message as well. I think it's very upfront and honest. It's been very easy for McLaren to just do a sort of two-line thing here, saying for reasons we don't want to get into, he's leaving. They could still say, you know, mutual decision, amicable parting and all that, but they wouldn't have to go into this detail. I really like the fact that they're very upfront about it. You know, there's a quote from Andrea Stella saying, you know, that they've recognised that there was a misalignment between what the role was maybe supposed to be or what David Sanchez thought he was joining for and how it's turned out. So I'm impressed with that. Obviously, as you say, it's not good news. This was a much touted structure. We can't look past the fact this was a big deal that we've been told about for a long time, and very quickly are having to make a change. But if it's not working, make the change quickly and just get on with it. This is a much better way of dealing with it than dragging it out or hoping it would fix itself or anything like that. So once they've realised it's not working out, they've taken the best action they can.
You know, and the positive is they did almost have a spare technical leader caliber individual, because Neil Hulde, who's now technical director of engineering, he was originally going to have the role that Rob Marshall took, and then he agreed to stick with being his deputy because Rob Marshall became available, and Marshall's experience with Red Bull meant that McLaren didn't feel they could turn down the opportunity to get him. Now, again, that's not a positive, but it means it's slightly less disruptive than it might be. Obviously, Andrea Stella keeping an eye on the performance side as that kind of interim technical director performance probably isn't ideal, but he's keeping a close eye on...
That's the bit that concerns me more, actually, than all the rest of it. And I think Stella's transitioned brilliantly into the team boss role, and I don't like the idea of him having to do a bit of his old job on the side. They've said that's a temporary measure, and I'm sure he's competent enough to juggle the two. But it's now key, I think, that they don't let that bit drag, because you can't have your team boss, who appears to be doing a really good job, suddenly spread too thin. There was all kinds of rumours, weren't there, about how thinly spread was Mattia Binotto at Ferrari when he got bumped up to team principal. And it was never quite clear if he was really that involved with the other parts of the job or with the other parts of his old job. But it was just that nagging thing in the background at Ferrari, wasn't it? Whenever things didn't quite work out, it was a question that came up. So if McLaren let this drag on and there's any point where they hit a bump in the road on this road to recovery that they're on, that will come up again for Stella as well. And so they, you know, that's the bit McLaren has to deal with now.
And obviously it's a role that Sanchez didn't want or didn't envision that was going to be right for him this year as well, and that's the role that they've got to go out and find somebody else to do. So if it wasn't right for Sanchez, you know, it might not be right for some other people looking at it. I guess that's kind of an element of this technical structure that they have, is that they have, you know, so many kind of bigger names within this technical structure, but it's probably hard for there to be kind of creative space for all these different names. So I'm interested to see what kind of figure are they going to get, you know, for that role permanently. Is it going to be somebody senior at a different team, or is it going to be somebody a bit more junior? It's going to be interesting to see.
It is interesting that they've changed it around a bit. So you've got now design, engineering, aerodynamics and performance as kind of the four positions now. So that car concept phraseology is gone. Maybe that was a little bit of a nod to what they'd originally brought Sanchez in for. And possibly there's an opportunity to balance up their technical leadership better rather than making allowances for that. Again, that might be being a bit generous in terms of saying something that's clearly disruptive is not a bad thing, but it seems like it's a good direction for them to go, and then it's much better at happening now than when they well advanced with work on the 2026 car in particular. And this is an important period over the next 12 months as well in terms of sorting the slow corner weaknesses and all the other things they've been working on and that they're targeting improving over the next at least a year, as Stella puts it. So yeah, interesting to see what McLaren say about that when they have to face the media at Suzuka this weekend. But Glenn, talking of Suzuka, this track's probably the toughest test of cars so far this year, particularly in terms of high speed performance, and we expect some upgrades to be appearing. So how revealing do you expect this weekend to be?
I think it'd be very revealing for the reasons you've mentioned there, but also, as you mentioned in your intro, I think the fact that this is Suzuka at an untypical time of the year. Suzuka and Japan has always been at the back end of the year. now we're coming back to Suzuka not that long after we were there last time. And it reminds me a little bit of every now and then this happens, doesn't it? A race shunts its position in the calendar. And one that I recall was when the Malaysian Grand Prix went from the back end of the year to race two, which I think was 2000 and then 2001. And everyone was a bit surprised that the new 2001 cars weren't that much faster than they'd been at the back end of 2000 with the previous year's cars. And the teams kind of had to explain to everyone, well, that's how car development works. Like, normally, you see a leap from one year to the next at each circuit because it's roughly 12 months since they were there before. So a lot of car development has happened. Then you do a new car, that takes another step on. But when you go from a race that's late in one year to early the next, you don't see that same sort of step. So what's going to be really interesting is that we have this shorter time frame that we can measure everybody's progress at a track, as you say, Ed, as special and as challenging as Suzuka is. And to keep it with McLaren initially, they're the team I'm most interested in seeing how they go this weekend, because Suzuka last year was a massive weekend for McLaren and the journey they went on in 2023. And, you know, McLaren were suddenly there. They were the team chasing Max Verstappen around Suzuka. And it really felt like that was the moment that this narrative of, you know, McLaren, we are coming for Red Bull now. We're after them. That was where that really took hold. And then I've been a little bit disappointed. Prior to Australia, I was a bit disappointed what we saw from McLaren in the first couple of races. And I was disappointed that the narrative was almost ignoring what they'd said the previous year and what they'd said a bit in pre-season as well. Suddenly it was like, oh no, long journey. You know, really we're looking, 2025 is when we're going to have to fix some of these problems. And I just thought, that's not what you were saying when everything looked mega at Suzuka. Australia was better, a track that suited their car better. This, though, I think is the big test for McLaren, because you look at how good they were at Suzuka, what was it, 6 months ago, maybe a little bit more than that, a little bit less. And now we're going to see them back there and we're going to get a real idea of how is their progress compared to Red Bull, to Ferrari, and maybe Mercedes, but probably not. But I think, you know, you've got the added element here that Ferrari are getting their act together. So even if McLaren have stayed relatively close or a similar gap away from Red Bull as they were at Suzuka last time, where do they fit around Ferrari? And if they aren't as impressive or as close to Red Bull as they were last year at Suzuka, I think that is a big concern, because that, for all the talk of suddenly it's a longer term project to fix all this stuff, if you've taken a step backwards from this track where you look great at the back end of last year, that's disappointing.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested to see how McLaren fare against Ferrari. I think that's the key thing. Obviously, McLaren were clearly quicker than Ferrari at Suzuka last year. I think it could be quite close this year between those two. So I'm interested to see how they get on. Josh, what's catching your eye in terms of Suzuka and what it'll tell us?
Yeah, it's going to be a huge weekend for Mercedes. You know, they've had a miserable start to this year, and we know that they had a really big high-speed weakness once again. And obviously, there's plenty of those fast corners at Suzuka, so it could be quite a painful weekend for them. They've never really had, you know, the last couple of years, they've really struggled in this ground effect era there. If you remember last year, both Hamilton and Russell were fighting really hard on track and getting in each other's way and that kind of thing. I'm interested to see if there'll be a continuation of that this year, with obviously Russell having the upper hand over Hamilton so far this year. You know, that gap between them is close, so will that lead to more battling there, and what are they actually going to be fighting over? Because if McLaren have a better weekend this year, like they did last year, then where does that leave Mercedes? Are we going to be seeing them fighting for 6th, 7th, 8th? Or is there any hope that they can take a step forward? To me, based on the first few races, there isn't, without a significant upgrade or without any kind of major new parts here. I don't see really how this track is going to suit them and bring them any closer to that podium fight they want to get to. I think they seem to be, well, they're going to have to basically be looking a bit further down the calendar for, I think, where their step forward is going to come from.
Ed, you might be able to correct me if I've got this wrong, but I think, didn't we come out of Suzuka last year with Mercedes basically saying the car was so bad or was so tricky to drive here that it was a load of red flags for kind of the direction we thought they were going in? And I would say all of those fears so far this year have been realised, haven't they? So I'd suspect they're probably quite nervous about going back to Suzuka.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I was reminded of this a few days ago as I was looking back at some of the videos we'd done on our YouTube channel, and we did one on that about the red flags from Suzuka.
That was it, yeah.
Ahead of going into next year. And of course, they really struggled in the snake, the S's section, the high-speed changes of direction in the first part of the lap. And it's funny, because I asked George Russell ahead of the Bahrain Grand Prix, how confident are you? You've got that rear-end stability, and if you went to Sector 1 at Suzuka tomorrow, it would be pretty good. And he said, well, there's nothing that's telling us it would be a problem. Well, I think there is now quite a bit telling them it might be a problem. Yeah. So I'm interested to see where they end up being. And of course, we will see various upgrades dotted around. I think Ferrari will have a few bits and pieces, perhaps not the biggest. Alpine say they've got a new front wing, the first step of their lightweighting. I think they've got a new floor they're working on that they're quite hopeful about, but I don't believe that will be at Suzuka. So there's lots of teams that will have their first, what you might call proper upgrade of the season, if you want to put it that way.
Well, it's kind of the way the calendar's gone as well, isn't it? It's a bit of a strange thing in terms of when is there going to be that first big race where we see loads of upgrades. You know, the European season doesn't kind of start properly until about May time. So are we kind of expecting what would sometimes come a bit earlier in the season to kind of happen around then? And, well, it kind of gives the teams a bit of an excuse, as they always like to use, in terms of, oh, let's wait until race five, or let's wait until the start of the European season. It kind of brings back that common excuse, and I think we'll probably continue to see that this weekend, because teams will be saying, oh, we need to wait for our first major upgrade, or we need to wait a couple of races, and that's probably only going to continue this weekend. Elsewhere on the grid, I'd point out Ferrari as well. Obviously, Carlos Sainz had a fantastic weekend in Melbourne. And, you know, can Charles Leclerc come back this weekend? We saw that last year here in Suzuka. Obviously, partly that was because of a new floor last year. But that was kind of the start of Leclerc getting back on top of Sainz after Sainz's really strong kind of Spa Monza Singapore run. So I'll be interested to see if Leclerc can do that. We so often see swings between the Ferrari drivers, so it's probably not out of the realms, but we could see another one this weekend. Leclerc's generally gone strong around here, but Sainz is obviously coming with a momentum. So, yeah, there's a good kind of couple of intra-team fights. Same at Mercedes, with there being such a tight gap between Hamilton and Russell as well. So there's a bit of interest there, but I guess their main priority is going to be seeing the performance of their car. And then their kind of intra-team squabbles, if they're that far off Red Bull, it isn't really going to matter, and especially in terms of Mercedes.
I was going to say, we haven't really talked about Red Bull yet. Ed, should we clear up the supposed Red Bull Zero pods that were once rumoured to be appearing at Suzuka?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that, and it always surprised me, because that would have required some pretty big structural changes. As I understand it, there is a significant Red Bull upgrade, as you'd expect, but it's not going to be a complete transformation of the shape of the car or anything. I imagine it may well be a little bit more slimline and tightly packaged, if indeed they can find ways to do that, but I don't believe it's going to be this zero pod approach as has been talked about. Could be wrong. They could surprise us, but it sounds like it's just a nice evolutionary step with the car they've got. And why do anything else? Because it's working really well. They're well ahead. So just keep on ploughing that development furrow, and they should be able to stay ahead this year. But yeah, it will be interesting to see what kind of performance gains they can get from this. And Suzuka, of course, is a great test of what you might call the underlying car upgrades, as in you don't bring really circuit specific stuff to Suzuka, you bring your pure performance aero stuff to Suzuka, because that's what's tested there. So this is really the baseline of the cars that we're seeing being improved.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. $5, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. Right, Josh. Drivers are often asked which their favourite track is. Often their answers vary according to who is asking and where they're being asked. But where does Suzuka really stand?
It's one of the best tracks, both in terms of the driver's point of view and surely the fan's point of view as well. It's a fantastic driving challenge. It's, I think, really good for racing. You know, so often here we see proper overtakes. I mean, sometimes DRS down the main straight gives a fairly easy to overtake into turn one, but so often, time and time again, we see some really, really, you know, proper overtaking manoeuvres. Probably if you stacked up, you know, which track has the most overtakes, Suzuka's not going to be at the top. But when you look at the quality of the overtakes, I think Suzuka's going to be, you know, really high up there. Qualifying's always an exciting challenge. Drivers are properly punished for the mistakes. You know, it's a classic example of a fantastic old school track, and it's still, unlike some other classic tracks, absolutely relevant for these modern cars, and has kind of you know, moved with the times despite not having really any kind of major changes for quite a while. I think this layout works just as well with these cars as it did 20 years ago. So yeah, it's a great track. There's been a bit of talk about Osaka holding a street race elsewhere in Japan, and there's always going to be chat. Tokyo obviously hosted its first Formula E race just last weekend. I'm sure they'll inevitably be a discussion about a race there that pops up sometime soon. But I'm really hopeful that Suzuka will remain on the F1 calendar. I think it's got a contract until 2029, so it's got a good deal at the moment, and that will just hopefully continue to be extended, because it's a great driver's circuit and a great fan circuit as well. Sometimes you get circuits which the drivers love, but really the races there are just really dull to watch. This is definitely the exception, because it's both great to watch and great for the drivers to, drive.
The big thing for me beyond the driving challenge, obviously Suzuka, an incredible track, at least a fast-flowing layout. The big thing that Josh mentioned there is you get punished for mistakes, and that doesn't always mean you hit something, although there's plenty of close-by barriers that you can hit at Suzuka. But it means that drivers have to weigh up more of how hard they're willing to push, particularly in qualifying, but even in a race as well, because you can't, there's very few places where you can just bail out of it and head off track. We don't really hear, you never really hear track limits debates here, because the curbs are quite nasty, and they tend, even at somewhere like, say, the Spoon Curve, where they have put quite a big asphalt runoff now, you've got to bounce across a horrendous curb to get to that. So if you end up out there, you've ruined a lap, or you've lost a lot of time in the race. It's got the best of all worlds, just in terms of that balance. Like Josh said, it does still feel very old school. And I think that coupled with the layout, makes the challenge even greater for the drivers, because there are, if you built that layout now, it would be surrounded by asphalt runoff and the drivers would be able to take more liberties, because if something went wrong, they'd just run the other side of a white line and come back and have another go. You don't get that luxury at Suzuka.
And if I was Williams, this would not be the track I'd want next up when they may well have a similar situation to Melbourne. I think they're going to have a very nervy weekend. That's nothing to do with Albon or Sargeant. It's just the fact that this track is so tough, both in qualifying and in the race. And the last thing they need is another big shunt. And obviously, I think last year what Albon had that incident at the start, and I think Sargeant ended up in the side of Valtteri Bottas. And yeah, it's not going to be the easiest track. It's a nervy track for all the drivers and all the teams watching on. We've seen so often big shunts in qualifying as well. And weather-wise as well can always play an impact. I think there's a little bit forecasted for Sunday, but the weather forecast changes so much there that it'll probably be a different picture by the time you're listening to this or by the time of the weekend.
The thing that I really like about Suzuka as well is imagining what it was like before they had the chicane there, because if you look at that last corner, it was originally a really fast right-hander, just with no runoff at all. Obviously, it was a corner that could not survive, but just absolutely fantastic. It's great just to look at it and think, wow, before that chicane was in there, obviously this was pre-World Championship days for it, it was even more mighty. But yeah, it's a great circuit. Josh, when you started your initial answer to this question, you said it's one of the best. I think it's the best for all the reasons that have been discussed, because it just feels increasingly old school, doesn't it? It's always felt that way, but more and more now we're losing these sorts of tracks, and I just think the challenge is just fantastic here.
It's not modernised in the same way that, say, Spa or Silverstone have. Those layouts are still fast and you know, frenetic to drive, but everything around them has kind of been modernised a lot more. So they feel, you could say, credit to those circuits. They've kind of moved with the times more and with the demands of modern F1 and modern safety standards for the most part. Suzuka, I guess it must just be a local geographical thing that they can't just surround that track. Obviously, it crosses over itself, which doesn't help either. They can't just build in huge runoffs and push the barriers back everywhere. And there are places, you know, there's still places with gravel and that sort of thing as well. So it just, yeah, it's almost becoming an outlier in that sense, isn't it?
And I think if it's lacking any popularity, that is probably simply because from a European standpoint of the time zone of the F1 race, it's not, it's too early in the morning for people in the UK. And same with, it doesn't have that same celebrity appeal that some of the newer ones have. But I think anybody who, you know, watches F1 for the racing will have no complaints on that front. But that's probably why it's perhaps not one of the most well-known circuits or one of the most kind of popular ones among general fans. But I think anybody who's really committed to F1 and loves it will there's just no reason to not love this track. I think certain ones you can make arguments for and against, but really this one there's really very few.
I have to say the fans at Suzuka are something else as well. People will have seen photos of them and stuff in the TV coverage, but they really are like that. They're so dedicated. You drive into the circuit in the morning and they're all lined up everywhere. It's like another level from.
Do you have to sign many autographs, Ed?
Not too many. I did some selfies with people in Australia. There are quite a few of those. I say quite a few. I basically mean maybe two a day, which is not very many, given the average driver gets through two a second when they're going in. But we'll have to see how much the stardom has spread. Probably not very much, but they are hugely dedicated fans, and there's always lots of fans quite a lot of fans in the paddock, a smattering, not like my Miami paddock where you struggle to move around just for people, but it's just got a nice feeling from that perspective. It's quite a fan-friendly circuit and some great places to watch too.
Those fans, they all sit in the grandstands on a Thursday as well, don't they, even when there's not any track action?
Yeah, it's one of those races that there's not many of them where the Thursday's like a normal day. I mean, Australia's like that, but Australia, there's on-track action on the Thursday as well. Not for Formula One, but for the other category, so it's part of the event. But yeah, it's really something else, Suzuka. And it's very, very hard, and it's easy for me to say. I'd say people should always try and get to Suzuka if they possibly can, and that's a lot easier said than done. And I know I'm very fortunate to have been there quite a few times, but it is everything you'd hope and more when you get there. And it is everything about it just feels so different to any other circuit, which is why it's just fantastic. And I hope it produces a great race. And this is a track that should always be on the F1 calendar, no matter what, I would say. And I think I'd put that above every other circuit personally because of what it represents as a driving challenge. So yeah, always a highlight.
Well, you mentioned the street race possibilities. Suzuka's obviously got quite a long-term contract that it's in the middle of. You'd hope that Honda's kind of power and influence would be able to keep it on the calendar. But yeah, of all the tracks that we could potentially lose to this, you know, F1's modern push for street races, this one, it would be a disaster if you lost Suzuka to a street race.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's one of a small number of circuits that are just so steeped in history. And that's even though Suzuka only joined the World Championship in 87, which I know is quite a long time ago now. But it's not like a Monza or a Monaco or a Silverstone that was there in the 50s at the start of the World Championship and has a history that stretches back even before that. But it is a massively illustrious track, although obviously its own history does stretch back before 87. It held the Japanese Grand Prix, not as an F1 race, for many years as well. But yeah, it just has to remain. I think it's got another 5 years after this year on the contract. And yeah, Suzuka and Spa and Monza are probably the three that are absolutely sacrosanct. And I put them ahead of Silverstone because Silverstone's obviously kind of flitted in and out a little bit over the years. Other circuits have held the British Grand Prix. So just in terms of that history, but yeah, it's right up there with the great traditional circuits that should not be forsaken, I would argue, not just because of respective history, but because it's brilliant. It's just an absolutely great track.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Right, Glenn, Yuki Tsunoda, he goes into his home race on a strong run of form. He outpaced Daniel Ricciardo first three weekends of the year. He finished seventh last time out in Australia. When he came into F1, there was hope he could finally be the first Japanese driver to win a world championship race, but his future still remains in the balance. How convinced are you by his progress?
I think he's doing a good job. Unfortunately, I don't think a good job gets you any further up the grid, really, from where he is now. I've had a suspicion since the back end of last year, really, that this Tsunoda versus Ricciardo thing would probably end with all they would achieve is that they'd guarantee that neither of them are ever able to step up to, say, Red Bull Racing or for another top team to pluck them away from Red Bull 2 as we'll call it. So I think we've talked about it on previous podcasts, and Helmut Marko has kind of backed this up as well, really, that out of those two, if either of those two are going to go anywhere, they need to smash the other one. And I'm not certain that's going to happen enough. So I can see Tsunoda doing a good job, and that potentially being enough to kind of kill Daniel Ricciardo's dream of getting back into a Red Bull one day. But I'm not sure that's going to come with the combination of, oh, okay, well, you've prevented Ricciardo's passage back to the A team. That means you're going to get it instead. Tsunoda's doing a pretty good, or very, very good job as a midfield driver. I don't necessarily see, with how long he's been around as well now, I don't necessarily see a cast iron case being made that he should be in one of the, you know, one of the top teams that could give him what you mentioned there, that chance to become the first Japanese driver to win a world championship race. I'm not sure that's on the cards.
Yeah, this is year four for him in F1, and that's the problem. I feel like the damage is already done. You know, how he compared to Gasly was just not really good enough, especially when you saw what Gasly did at Red Bull. Why would Red Bull then think, oh, let's put Tsunoda in alongside Verstappen? I think that would be, unfortunately, a recipe for disaster, and that's no disrespect on Tsunoda. He's a perfectly solid, capable Grand Prix driver, but to me that would just
be... He's well worthy of his place in F1. It's just that place is where he is now, I think.
Absolutely, and really, yes, you can say, okay, he's unlucky and he's overlooked, but also, you know, Red Bull-supported drivers have been sacked for less than some of the performances he showed in the first couple of years. I think he's done well and he's good to get to year four, but, you know, some other drivers wouldn't have got the same chance. So it's a bit of both, kind of. Yes, he is underappreciated in some ways, but he's also had a little bit of fortune along the way as well. That really strong Honda link has obviously helped him stick around in F1, and if anything's going to keep him on the grid, or if anything's going to get him to Aston Martin, then obviously that will help, and his added performance this year will help, because he's made a good case. He would clearly be an upgrade on Lance Stroll at Aston Martin.
Agreed.
But would he be someone to replace Fernando Alonso? I've never thought so. You know, if Alonso leaves there, I just can't see them going for a Tsunoda Stroll lineup. That doesn't scream to me like a potential lineup they could go with. And unfortunately, when you look at just basically any other team, including some of the midfield teams, like the future Audi Sauber team, you look at the options there, and Tsunoda's not in the top two there of the options available. I think he's really going to need things to go his way for to stay on the grid next year. RB, and I think on merit, you know, could keep him and probably should keep him for one more year. But beyond that, it's really hard to see where he fits in. He's going to need a bit of driver market, you know, favorance really in his way for a few different pieces to fall his way and create an opening. Because at the moment, it's kind of hard to see, not only I think where he fits in at the front of the grid, but to be honest, even elsewhere in the midfield, it's going to be hard to find an opening, especially with, you know, plenty of drivers coming into F1 as well, potentially for next year.
He's an interesting driver because there's a lot of pace there. As he keeps saying, no, there's nobody who's as good on the brakes as he is, and he is great on the brakes. He's got quite a late braking, quite fast initial rotation style. He sets good lap times, as we've seen up against Ricciardo. But, and to use a phrase that I wouldn't use, but Tsunoda used this about himself, so I have quoted it in something I've written about him. He referred to getting heating moments in my brain. And this is all about the emotional control, which is another phrase he's used recently over the past 6 months. He said it multiple times, that emotional control in the cockpit. And it's not just about shouting over the radio. That's kind of the most obvious thing. But it's just in those pressure point moments, making the right sound decision. Mexico last year, when he was on a bit of a charge later on the quick tyre, trying to pass Piastri, got a bit impatient, had the clash with him, went off, and he compromised his result there. And then into Lagos as well in the Grand Prix, had a spin, could have finished seventh in that race, finished ninth instead. And just these little mistakes when things get a bit stressed and complicated are what worry me. And obviously he had that thing on Bahrain at the end, in the Bahrain Grand Prix at the end of the race, when he was annoyed about the team orders. And I don't care what communication problems there'd been with the team, etc., and what had been talked about behind closed doors, what he was doing on the slowdown lap just shows a lack of control. And it really is a shame, because there is a driver with real pace in there. And I must admit, to come back to that point about where he ends up in the driver market, he's in an interesting little position, because if you find yourself, let's say, down the queue for picking your drivers, you often end up in a situation where you have a choice between what I'd call a solid pair of hands and someone like Tsunoda, who's got a high upside, maybe could be a bit erratic, but if you can really help him with that mental side and get him in the zone, you can actually get some really good performances out of him. There's a hint of the Grosjean about him, manifests itself slightly differently, but it's that kind of realm. So he becomes an interesting wild card in the driver market, but I'm worried that emotional control side hasn't advanced as much as it needs to, anywhere near as much as it needs to. He said himself recently that I need more than two steps on this. He needs multiple steps in terms of just getting everything under control. And if he does, he's a fast driver because he is dominating Ricciardo at the moment. Okay, three races out, 24. But very, very interesting. And he's determined to prove himself to Red Bull and other teams. So if he can keep this up, he'll be in a good position.
How long do you give him to develop that emotional control, though? Because I know he was kind of fast-tracked into F1. So I do think that you didn't have to be too judgmental of how much of the complete package he was at the beginning. But as Josh said, he's been around a while now. And I really think, and this is one of the reasons I think the top teams aren't looking at him, is that top teams are only really in the market for drivers who make a big impression quickly. And these guys who need a bit longer, who maybe arrive a little bit early, but need a bit longer, there's a bit of preconditioning that goes on there in the minds of the top teams. And they just think, well, if you were a real superstar, if you were a guy that could win us multiple races a year, if we give you a quick enough car, you'd have shown more by now. So I admire Yuki's honesty in saying what he's got to develop about his game. But at what point do we say, like we do with Lance Stroll, you've been here a while, like how much longer do you need to get this stuff right?
Yeah, well, it's not a given that he'll get it right, ultimately. If he was in his first year, you'd say, well, okay, we can assume progress will be made.
Yeah.
But it is taking too long. There's always the possibility, he's only 23, he gets to a point where it all clicks. It's possible. However, it's more likely this is just something about the way his mind works. It's just a slight weakness. You know, elite sports are very, very difficult. It is high pressure. It is super tough to do this. And I think, as you alluded to, quite a lot of the conditioning and the way you develop, it's locked in earlier in your mind. So it's not impossible, but I in no way would say it's a given, which is why I kind of see him as a, if you're lower down the pecking order in the driver market picks, you might think, well, I'd rather take someone with a potential high upside and take the risk than someone who's just a bit boringly solid.
If Tsunoda can increase that upside of the performance, then that could offset the brain overheating that he talked about. Because I have a feeling that still on raw potential and raw pace, you know, he would be an upgrade on a few drivers further down the field. So perhaps when it all shakes out, somebody like Alpine or somebody in the midfield just thinks, you know what, we'll give him a shot because the pure performance that he's showing this year, you know, to be a step up on Ricciardo is no mean feat. Yes, Ricciardo's having lots of problems, but the margin is really impressive, and some of the qualifying performances in particular that Tsunoda's putting down, you know, really impressive. He's really doing what, you know, Gasly was doing in midfield teams and doing what other drivers have done. It's just unfortunate that downside is there, but I'm not actually convinced that solving that is the only way for him to stay on the grid. I think if he can keep showing this performance, then even with that downside, I think he could still find a future elsewhere. But yeah, as with anything, it remains to be seen.
And ultimately, Perez is on a decent trajectory at the moment. The first two weekends were good. Australia was a bit disappointing. We did have some floor damage in the race as well, which held him back a little bit. So I think that the chances of Perez hanging on in that seat have increased a bit so far this season. Still a long way to go, but it doesn't look great for either of those drivers in RB in terms of getting into that seat. And if they were to dispense with Perez, and they may very well not need to, they might well have to look outside of their driver stable to replace him.
Well, that seems where it's gone, isn't it? It's basically gone from being an internal fight for that second seat to now seemingly it's already gone external. It's already gone potentially Carlos Sainz, potentially Fernando Alonso. You know, that's where the conversation has moved. Obviously, that can be different from what's actually going on in Red Bull. But the longer this goes on, it's just become a case of who's the best driver outside of Red Bull to partner Max Verstappen rather than inside. But yeah, like you say, Perez has made the strongest start of those three, probably, but it's still not where it's convincing, where you hand him a contract tomorrow. Red Bull might as well wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah, Tsunoda would probably need to reel off another 20 Australian Grand Prix weekends to persuade Red Bull to seriously consider him. But there's always a chance, and there is real ability. There's a driver in there, and it'd be great if it can really coalesce well. Now, Glenn, we don't normally talk two wheels on this podcast, but it is worth a quick mention because Liberty Media is buying MotoGP. So how big a deal is that for the commercial landscape of motorsport as a whole to have F1 and MotoGP owned by the same entity in terms of commercial rights?
Yeah, I think this is fascinating. So Liberty are effectively acquiring, I think it's 86% of Dorna Sports, which is the promoter of MotoGP. So yeah, for shorthand, you can say they're effectively buying MotoGP. Really interesting. Hard to say at this stage. Obviously, we're still waiting on regulatory approval for this. But I think it's got the potential to be fascinating. It should be good news for MotoGP because Liberty's done a good job of raising, whether you like the things that Liberty has done with F1, they've done a good job of raising the profile of F1. So if they can, and they're talking about taking some of those learnings and applying them to MotoGP, which has been left behind. MotoGP was ahead on some things like social media and that sort of thing back when F1 was in the Stone Age on that front, under the Bernie Eccleston era, but it's been definitely left behind. It's struggling to find its feet sort of in the post Valentino Rossi era. It was one of those sports that was kind of built on the shoulders of a legend, like we see with many other sports. So could be really interesting. Too early to really say definitely what it's going to mean. I think there's some laws around this sort of thing that will mean this doesn't mean that MotoGP and F1 are about to become kind of one entity where these two great world championships are kind of run together. I don't think that'll be allowed. But if it gets through, if it gets the approval that we're expecting, these are the two biggest, I would say, they're the two biggest global motorsport championships. You can argue where NASCAR fits in that, and some people roll their eyes at that, but NASCAR's just done a massive TV deal in America. But to have these two massive sports under the same ownership is, I think it's fascinating. And to me, I don't know how you feel about it, Ed, but there's always this talk about what's Liberty's end game with F1. I kind of feel like if they're buying another motorsport championship, unless their plan was to pump F1 up and then sell it, and now they're going to try and do it again with two wheels, I kind of feel like this is a bigger commitment to motorsport in general from Liberty.
Potentially. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if F1 does get sold down the line. They've done a lot of things that perhaps point to that being a possibility, quite a lot of long-term race deals, that kind of thing.
Boost the share value.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe that is part of the plan. I don't know whether it's something they'll have committed to definitely happening, but the nature of the company means they may look at it. But they may also think this is a great opportunity to have these two properties side by side, but not too close as they have to be for regulatory reasons. So yeah, it is interesting. And I'm sure MotoGP will get some of the same treatment in terms of pushing the American market, that kind of thing. And it probably will help MotoGP in that regard, because I think ultimately I'm no expert at all in MotoGP. I like MotoGP, I respect it, but I wouldn't even call myself an engaged fan of it, because it's two-wheel racing doesn't quite do it for me in the same way four-wheel racing does. But it seems to me that a lot can be done with MotoGP in terms of putting it a bit more front and centre in front of people, making it less niche. And Liberty did that a bit with Formula One as well. Liberty was, F1 was more mainstream, but still had that niche vibe, whereas it kind of completely shed that niche feeling.
It's a global phenomenon now, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the positive of Liberty. I do have reservations with F1 about Liberty's ability to evolve it from here, because I think they've done a lot of things that have been beneficial, and I just worry that they've got a little bit stuck in a little, oh, just do more things. It's like,
yeah, how do you sustain it? What do you do next?
Do better, because everyone always wants growth, and there's a limit to how much growth there can be.
So someone told me something quite worrying a couple of weeks ago, actually. It was someone who works in TV, I think. Yeah, someone who works in TV who said they've heard that, obviously, whenever a new race gets added in F1, we go to 22 races. They say, oh, yeah, that'll be enough. 23, oh, that's enough. 24, yeah, we don't want to go past 24. But you talk to people in TV and they've heard that 25 is an option. They've heard that anywhere up to 30 is an option. As you said, Ed, adding more races, adding long-term race contracts, those are highly valuable. That's kind of the only way you can keep piling value on here without getting more creative. So it is, that does feel to me like that could just be a strategy of keep adding races, keep just boosting the volume of everything you've got, because then it just makes it even more valuable to sell.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe you neglect some of the more ethereal aspects of it, the custodianship of Grand Prix racing, if you don't mind me putting it that way.
You make that someone else's problem if you're going to sell it on, don't you?
Well, exactly. But ultimately, MotoGP is a long way from that. Okay, Liberty Media, they're not miracle workers. The ownership of F1's not been perfect, but there's been a lot of good. And I think it's very, very easy to be critical of Liberty Media, and sometimes on some things I am. But I think it would be very churlish to say there haven't been a net benefit to Formula One. Not absolutely everything has got better, but a lot has got better. And I think probably MotoGP will be exactly the same. But it feels to me like it's coming from a lower base in terms of the global recognition. So that first phase could actually, percentage-wise, growth-wise, be bigger for MotoGP than it was for F1.
You could argue that work has already started, because the way that MotoGP has evolved over the last few years has in many ways mirrored some aspects of F1. You know, they included sprint races, and much of their coverage and their docuseries have all kind of gone to the F1 pattern. I mean, F1 has been a bit of a trendsetter in motorsport in the last few years. You've seen multiple examples of other series trying to kind of copy or emulate what Liberty has done with F1. So you could argue that kind of Liberty's work to reshape MotoGP has already kind of started in the way that MotoGP has already started to do some of those things that that Liberty was probably already going to do. In some places, like the sprint race, obviously they've gone further. They've had one at every single weekend, which I would be very interested to see how well that would go down with F1 fans. I imagine not very. And maybe there could even be a tiny bit of crossover in terms of testing things out on one side or the other. I'm sure lessons both from F1 will be applied to MotoGP and vice versa. Whether or not for the better or worse, that'll be for the fans to decide.
The relationship between the two series has got a little bit closer on a kind of, on a gentle basis in recent years. Stefano Domenicali of F1 is a big admirer and fan of MotoGP. So like, we've had the F1 logo on the back of one team's bikes, the Pramac team, that are our front runners running Ducati machinery. But we also know that, you know, Domenicali and the Ezpeleta family, who effectively run MotoGP, they do talk. So they've discussed calendar clashes and that sort of thing in the past. And I'm certain they've compared notes on their two different approaches to sprint races. So yeah, I think if the MotoGP guys ever say to the F1 guys, well, actually, our Saturday TV ratings are massively up compared to when we do qualifying, I can see that giving the people behind sprint races for F1 a bit of encouragement. But I would say, I guess one thing that I doubt MotoGP will do in terms of the Liberty blueprint for growing a series, I don't think we're about to see a load of MotoGP street races, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I imagine there would be some pretty big safety concerns about that kind of thing. Again, not a specialist in the circuit homologation for MotoGP, but I'm not convinced that would make sense. But I think it's really important that MotoGP isn't just made into a two-wheeled F1. I mean, in broad terms, it is, because it's a similar sort of racing competition, but
they've even got wings now.
Well, exactly. Aero's causing problems there as well. But yeah, I think it's important that it also maintains the culture and the history and all those sorts of things, those intangibles. They are curating that as well. And that will be, quite rightly, very much at the heart of what makes bike racing fans love it. And it's at the heart of what will make new fans love it as well. That's the thing I find a bit strange with discourse on F1, this old versus new fans. I don't really get it. Everyone was a new fan at some point, and as you get absorbed in it, that you sort of build up your own history with it, and some gain an appreciation of the history before they were interested in it. And even those who don't maybe revel in the history, because you don't have to, just the fact they know it's there gives it something. So all those things are important, and I'm interested to see what they do. If you'd like to hear a little bit more about this Liberty takeover of MotoGP, do have a listen to our MotoGP podcast with Matt Beer, Val Horinji and Simon Patterson. They're recording pretty much in parallel with us, I think. So I've no idea what they're going to say, but they will really get into the whole Liberty Media takeover there. You'll be able to hear plenty more on our sister podcast there. Well, thanks very much to Josh and Glenn for your insight. Head to therace.com. Loads to read there. Don't forget the hyphen if you're heading to the website. Have a look at our YouTube channel as well and our many other podcasts, including the MotoGP pod, Bring Back V10s. And a quick reminder for those who are tempted by the Race Members Club with that new 1997 series coming up, check the link in the description or have a look at our website if you like the sound of that. Right, it's now full steam ahead to Japan, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.